You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Credo Mobile. With Credo, your voice reflects your values. Check out credomobile.com/majority for details.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, December 10th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the great Digby from the great blog Hullabaloo. Also on today's program, we get to that story about Virginia Fox. She doesn't like the little people riding in her elevators. Egypt still going through a tremendous amount of turmoil. The Obama administration trying to work out a plan on how they're going to enforce anti-marijuana laws on a federal level in states that have not only decriminalized it, but made it legal and have created an infrastructure in which to tax and regulate it. Also on the program, Michigan's headed to a right to curtail the contract of employees to organize. No, that's not so, it doesn't roll off the tongue. They call it right to work. It's a right to work for less. But with Digby today, we will talk about the floating of the lowering of the Medicare eligibility age and the battle on the left, or center left and left. It's a fascinating, what's going on right now is very fascinating in the context, to me anyways, and hopefully to you. In the context of, I don't want to call this a earth-shattering revelation that I had in my little joust with that Donahue Peebles on up with Chris a week ago now, Saturday. And I know I've been talking about this a lot because I think it's incredibly instructive for me. And a lot of things have sort of coalesced in the past couple of weeks that, both in terms of what I want to do with this program going forward, and also in the context of the new political situation we're in. One of the things that I was arguing as to why one of the benefits of having President Obama in office as opposed to Mitt Romney, pushing aside for a moment and not speaking of the myriad of other benefits, is that it really clarifies where the battle lines are being drawn on the left. My argument was, you know, look, if Mitt Romney was talking about lowering the Medicare eligibility age, there would be no intestine fighting on the center left or left because it is clearly a bad policy. However, now that President Obama will be the president, we have a stronger, more progressive Senate, marginally speaking, but it's definitely the case. We have a more progressive Democratic caucus albeit in the minority in the House. It is interesting and I think very important to watch how ideas germinate, how test balloons are floated, how we get a sense of where people stand on the spectrum of different major questions of policy and, frankly, ideology in some respects. We will be talking about this with Digby. But before we do, I have what I consider a very exciting announcement. For several months, I've been talking about, well, I guess maybe since the beginning of the show. When this show started off, I initially thought that what I wanted to do was to migrate this show to radio. And to a certain extent, we have done some of that. The show replays on WEAC Radio in Washington, D.C. I have had other offers since then to go onto smaller stations around the country. Not that many, and I haven't aggressively pursued them. The idea at the time I had is that I want to increase the reach of this show. A couple of things have dissuaded me from following that path. One is that we have had a great increase in listeners, particularly to the free show, which has expanded the show's reach. The other is that I've had plenty of opportunity to go on television and create a bit of an amplifier for the issues that we talk about on this show. And this show has given me enough credibility to maintain a presence on television at various junctures and various outlets. Sometimes I give talking points to people who have a bigger platform. But I wanted to figure out a way to amplify the voice of this show in some respects. Also, I've also been looking for good sponsorship. We up to this point, have taken two types of ads. One is that comes from the podcast server. And these are ads that come in Audible, Ting. I think maybe we've had one or two others from them that are ads, and I've rejected one or two from them too, that I just don't feel are appropriate. I don't look to those ads for, they're not seamlessly integrated into the material that we're talking about, but they're not offensive and not contradictory in my mind. The other types of ads we've had on the show have basically come from listeners who are attempting to do things that I think are either good businesses or because I just want to help expand the community, whether it's Decomposure's albums or the Strange Angels or even Hold Your Nose and Vote Obama. I mean, it was consistent with the message of this show. Some degree and, you know, people who have been supportive of the community built around the Majority Report. All the while, I have been looking for a substantial sponsor, and I have talked to different activist groups over the months, arguably years. I have talked to, I've played around with the idea of maybe we get a union sponsorship. Invariably, the problem with these type of sponsorships is because I don't necessarily have a perfect political alignment with any of these groups. And because they're not entrepreneurial, there could be things that I say that they have a problem and it gets up and it complicates things. And the one thing that I have learned is that I don't necessarily like money being held over my head as a way of determining what I'm going to say on this program. It is a deep-seated psychological issue. It has gotten me fired from jobs in the past, from being a waiter at Casablanca back in the day in Cambridge, Mass. It wasn't necessarily political, but I had a differing perspective on what might work for the restaurant than the manager did. And he was drunk, and what do you want to do? All right, so I'm not going to disparage him. But, of course, I think to a certain extent at Air America, while I think this was a small part of it, is that I did not have the proper respect for the money people there. So I always have this in the back of my mind, and I think that we have found the perfect sponsor for this program. And I have spoken a couple occasions to people associated with this group. I have spoken to other people about this group, and it is Credo Mobile. Now, Credo Mobile, and my hope is in the next couple of days to have Becky Bond, who is one of the leaders of this group. And what they basically do, they're an entrepreneurial outfit. They used to be known as Working Assets. They are basically running a business and using a significant portion of their profits to promote progressive liberal ideals. And anybody you talk to out there in that activist world will tell you that Credo is incredibly strong. They are unintimidated by anybody. They're not looking for access. They are looking to use people power as a way of influencing the debate. And I don't know if there are any other groups out there that do it as well and are beholden to as few of the bigwigs who try and shape policy through their activist groups. And part of it is because basically they are funded by people like you who need a service, who want to do it responsibly, want their money that they spend on their phone service not to fund Tea Party candidates, not to be lobbying against things like whatever it is, net neutrality or monopolies for certain companies. And it also happens to be a great product. And so over the past couple of weeks, I think I had an opportunity to sit down with Becky both at Netroots and at I ran into her in D.C. at something a couple of months ago, I think it was. And, you know, it's something that we had talked about on very loose terms, but said, let's pick up this conversation after the election. And one of the things they already are in the business of supporting, like, Democracy Now, without now donations, but there is a perfect alignment of interests here, I think. And so we're going to do I think it's going to be a 3 or 4 week, maybe a month long. I'm not exactly sure. Experiment to see what kind of value I can bring to Credo Mobile and what kind of value they can bring to this program in terms of new listeners, because they have a huge outreach program. Progressives, activists out there, and progressives who are interested in letting their dollars do some work for them are associated with them. They're on their email lists, whatnot. And so I think this is going to be an incredibly mutually beneficial relationship. And on the free program, you're going to hear some ads. Occasionally on the program, I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to have, hopefully, and I'm still talking to them about this, but they run campaigns that I think are incredibly effective and increasingly important. And as we talk to Digby, you're going to understand the importance of this. When you start to understand the concept of trial balloons and why they're put out and who are the messengers that deliver this information and what we can do as progressives to respond to those trial balloons. And so my hope is in the next day or two to have Becky Bond tell you more about the company. But if you want to check it out now, we have a link on the site. You can go to credomobile.com/majority. It's not been branded. We just sort of put it together at this, because I wanted to do this now because for Christmas. They have great deals on phones. I'll talk more about the specifics, but go there now, check it out, see what's going on there. Many of you are already aware of Credo. Many of you already from the past have been aware of Working Assets. It's a great company. I've talked to a lot of people about this. I am generally not excited about things like this, but I think this is going to be great for the show. I think it's going to be great for you. And I really do believe it's going to be helpful for Credo. So it is a win-win-win. And I generally just need something that is like even half a win to be happy. So three wins, that's got me over the moon. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby. Hey folks, while AT&T and Verizon push a terrible corporate agenda, there's one phone company in America that raises millions of dollars a year to fight the right. Beating Tea Party candidates, funding the ACLU, and fighting for our values. It's easy to switch, the rates are great, and the phones are awesome. Join Credo Mobile, the official phone company of the Majority Report. Check out credomobile.com/majority. credomobile.com/majority for more details. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah. Yeah. And you was a man. Hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, dealing with the outage of Gmail, which has completely thrown us for a funk here. But on the phone, it is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program from the great Uber blog Hullabaloo, the great Uber blogger Digby. Welcome to the program, Digby.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So there is, you know, I wanted to talk to you at some time this week. I was anticipating wanting to talk to you before as we get closer to the holidays and the fiscal cliff, the fiscal curb, the austerity bump, whatever anybody has branded it out there. And then something really fascinating happened over the past week that for me started, and I think I noticed that you had flagged this clip, started, at least personally for me, with my going on Up with Chris and sitting next to a guy who I really had no idea who he was. After the fact, I Googled him, and I'm talking about Donahue Peebles, who is a member of the finance committee for President Obama, a big fundraiser for him, who was sort of out of the blue arguing that, sort of simultaneously arguing that maybe on the merits the estate tax should go away for civil rights reasons, but that's the way it's going to go. And then also arguing in a very similar way that the Medicare age eligibility age is probably going to have to go up. And not that he was sort of not arguing on the merits. As soon as I tried to question him on the merits, it was more about, hey, this is the political realities type of situation. And it became very transparent that this guy was actually arguing the merits of these policies, but couching it in this notion of, look, we got to make a deal, and this is sort of where it's going, and this is all just physics, and there's nothing we can do about it. And then, of course, I Googled him, and he turns out to be one of the wealthiest African-Americans in the country, not coincidentally. And this sort of erupted with the same thing with Ezra Klein and Jonathan Chait over the past week.
Well, yes. And I mean, this has been coming on for a while. There, I also saw Jim Clyburn also agree. You know, I don't know if you saw this, you know, proposal by Bob Corker, which came out maybe a week ago. He's the reason, the new, you know, House reasonable Republican who's, you know, saying, oh, we can agree to raise taxes, but this is what we need in return. And he set forth the idea of raising the Medicare age along with a bunch of other stuff. And he was on, I think it was just a couple of days after you were on with this gentleman, Peebles, saying, and with Jim Clyburn. And Jim Clyburn said, oh, I agree with all of that. And I was kind of startled, you know, what? where'd that come from? And, of course, Denny Hoyer and some others, that they've been out there saying this for a while as well. So this is in the ether. And it kind of erupted at the end of the week when Ezra Klein, well, first Jonathan Chait endorsed the idea, and which he did 2 years ago also in the pages of the New Republic, in which he endorsed the idea on the merits that the Medicare age should rise for, you know, for good reasons. People are living longer, all the usual BS. But Ezra reported that, you know, he was hearing from the White House that they were open to the idea. He said it absolutely. He stands by his reporting on that, despite the fact that others are now saying, well, I'm hearing the opposite. So that's where this came from. It seems to have... There is no doubt in my mind that this is in the ether, either as a trial balloon, which is certainly possible, or this is truly where this deal is crystallizing around the idea of slightly higher tax rates. And by the way, the tax rates, part of this discussion is that the tax rates aren't actually going to go up as much as you know, they want, in exchange for raising the Medicare eligibility age. So that's where this is coming from. And the fact that this guy that you were on the show with, Mr. Peebles, that he was also hearing that is just another indication that this is part of their, part of the discussions among the insiders.
And this is the sort of the tricky part about this is that when someone says, I'm hearing this, there's really sort of two reactions you can have, right? One is this is, and let's take the Medicare eligibility age, because while Jonathan Chait may have argued in favor of it on the merits a couple of years ago, it is quite clear now, and now he seems to be arguing it just because he says the relative value to the Republicans in terms of their ability to sort of, as a scalp, is greater than what he perceives the policy implications to be, which I think is also a weak argument in and of itself. But there seems to be a surprising amount of universal agreement that raising the Medicare eligibility age is horrible policy from any standpoint. Not only is it bad for the people who could die because they don't have Medicare eligibility, though Chait would describe this as tolerable, although not maybe not if he was faced and looking at it that way, but it also does not save any money. It costs more money in the end. You could respond on the merits, or you could simply say, like, this is what I'm hearing, and it's just heading in that direction, and maybe we should just get behind it. And so there's a question as to whether, when someone is presenting that, whether they are actually not arguing for it, but just in the guise of, this seems to be happening.
Well, that's certainly possible. I mean, there is that feedback loop and the idea that, well, you know, this train has left the station and there's no stopping it. I mean, you do get that feeling a lot in these fiscal cliff discussions that it's kind of got a life of its own. And the idea also that is sort of just intrinsic to the idea of these, you know, quote, negotiations, which is that there has to be some concession. What's it going to be? And the Democrats, we know the hill they're going to die on. They've made that very, very clear. They must have tax increases. And I've really gotten nothing from virtually any of them that says what their bottom line is in terms of what they're prepared to give up in order to get that. In fact, the deal has seemed to me for many months, and I've written this, you know, to the point where my readers are ready to kill me, is that, you know, that the entire deal has been structured around the idea that the Democratic victory is based upon getting a hike in tax rates. And that is the essence of the victory. It's not, you know, protecting Medicare and Medicaid. It's not, you know, trying to, you know, the president terms it a balanced approach. But the only thing he's been specific about has been the tax hikes, that they have to go up for the wealthiest 2%, which I'm not unhappy about. I mean, of course, I think they should go up. They're doing very well in this economy. I don't think it will have adverse effects on our economy, generally speaking. But that, you know, but nonetheless, that seems to be the only thing that the Democrats have said is their bottom line in this deal. So, you know, that we've accepted that as, well, there has to be a concession. The Democrats are going to get their tax hike, so what are the Republicans going to get out of this? And I say nothing. You know, I realize that one should not say that, but you know, the president won the election.
Well, but here's the other rub is that if this is the hill that the Democrats want to die on, there's an easy way for them to actually not have to die on this hill, and that is to
absolutely.
Do absolutely zero. All they need to do, I mean, every Democrat in Washington could say, I'm going on vacation for the next 3 weeks starting today. And when they come back, they will have won. If that, they do need to do nothing. They can come back, force the Republicans to vote against a tax cut for anybody who is making or every dollar made under $250,000. And then, you know, and of course, Republicans, how could they vote against that? Maybe they could, but not at an extreme political cost to them. One which would never end, right? I mean, because on day one, you suggested, on day two, you suggested, you keep suggesting it every day. So this is the sort of the trick that's been set up here is that if this is the thing that's most important to them, there's an easy way to deal with it. Go on vacation, do nothing, spend the day in the next 3 weeks in the Bahamas, I don't know, where do people go on vacation? But that's all they need to do.
Absolutely. And of course, it's what they should do, because you reset the entire argument when they come back and, you know, the taxes have gone up. Everybody gets to be a tax cutter at that moment. Suddenly, you know, they can link arms and, you know, strut around saying, look how many taxes with the Obama tax cuts. They're just, you know, look what we've done for you now. And, of course, they have the sequester coming up. And that's not, you know, that also is another one. Look, we're going to raise defense spending. It's all been cut to hell. And now look at us. We're going to raise it. We're going to do this, that, and the other. I mean, it resets the entire argument, which was, of course, the whole point. So the idea that, you know, there is some argument out there that going over the cliff, the so-called cliff, will cause the markets to be upset for 5 minutes. And, you know, I suppose that might happen, but it hasn't happened up to now in any of these things. So, you know, I suspect that the markets are a little less irrational about this stuff than people think.
So the real leverage that the Republicans have, because they have no leverage on the tax, on the raising of the tax, because that's going to happen. In fact, we can count on that happening if nobody does anything, more than we can count on having snow this year in winter, or mm-hmm. it getting a cold snap, or just about anything else. There's nothing more definitive than them getting those taxes. The real leverage seems to be the debt ceiling, and the other wants supposedly from the administration and from the left would be, of course, to avoid the sequester cuts on non-discretionary spending and to provide some measure of stimulus for the economy in the form specifically of things like extended unemployment benefit insurance, unemployment benefits, perhaps something to replace the Social Security moratorium tax cut, some type of earned income tax cut, or just you could, I guess, if you when you offer the package of tax cuts, you could include that at that time. I don't see why you couldn't do that. You could also offer it as part of the tax cuts, the unemployment benefits. So you've got all that, and the only card that the Republicans have is to threaten to kill the economy again. And I have to imagine, even though I don't put it past the Republicans to do it, to vote against raising the debt ceiling, I have to imagine it's going to come at an even greater political cost than it did last time, because one, you don't have the president is not up for reelection, so he can't suffer the implications of that. And two, we've already gone through this with the Republicans. The fix that they wanted was the sequester, and now they don't even want that. It seems to me it's very hard to argue that there is any reason for the Democrats now to make a deal before January 1.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've thought so for some time. Granted, this debt ceiling issue and the sequester and all those things, they are out there. And, you know, it would be very nice if we could tie all this up in a nice little bow. The Republicans come to the White House and say, we understand the error of our ways. We lost the election. We're changing completely. We're going to be good partners in the loyal opposition. Let's end this now. That's not happening, and it's not going to happen. So let's just stop pretending that's going to happen and move beyond. Go ahead and reset this whole thing so that the tax cuts expire. And if the Republicans decide to hold the debt ceiling hostage again, there has to come a point at which the Democrats, you know, absolutely say, no, we're not doing this. This is because if they don't, this will never end. This will happen over and over and over again. And there are, you know, I realize that they're trying to find legal ways for the president to control the debt ceiling and all of that. But until John Boehner is no longer Speaker of the House, that's probably not going to happen. So they have to put it into this in some political way, which is to say either stop doing this or you are going to hold, you know, be held responsible for the consequences of doing it. Otherwise, I think government is in permanent gridlock because of it.
I want to just go back a little bit, because one of the things that supposedly, and, you know, Jonathan Chait doesn't make this argument too explicitly, though he makes this argument to a certain extent. He says that the value to Democrats, while you have the Republicans sort of overpriced the value of cutting Medicare eligibility, essentially privatizing the ages of 65 and 66 for people who are in Medicare now, that the value to the Democrats is that it will push those people into Obamacare, presumably in 2014, and this is going to create an even stronger, more intimate support for Obamacare, because these 65 and 66 year olds who've basically been thrown over overboard will be hanging on to Obamacare as a life preserver, literally, in some instances. Now, what's amazing about this argument is that it's been shot down by a lot of other policy people, but for the obvious, including some obvious things that, like, hey, you know, it's not quite clear what Obamacare is going to be for at least 5 years, because you have all these court cases and you have Republican governors saying we're not going to pick up the slack with Medicaid, which would presumably fill that gap.
Well, yeah, I mean, that, you know, number one, I mean, that's just, it's absolutely absurd to think that Obamacare is in any position to be picking up the slack on that particular population of citizens, because it's not even in place yet. And it's not just Medicaid. It's also the exchanges. You know, a lot of the states are refusing to set those up. And so that will fall to the federal government. We don't know how that's going to work. Look, Obamacare doesn't really exist at the moment. It's theoretical, and it's going to have a lot of things to work out if it's ever even going to work at all. You can't take that particular population of sick people, you know, and older people, and put them into something that doesn't exist. That's crazy. And in fact, it's mind-boggling to me that when it was just a couple of years ago when we were debating whether or not to lower the Medicare age during the healthcare debate, and that came very close. Of course, Joe Lieberman put the kibosh on that, but that was actually a very serious discussion that was in the healthcare debate to lower it to the age of 55, and now we're talking about raising it. I mean, that's insane. But one of the things that I think that's important to point out about this, this is sort of a sidebar, but it's important because the idea that Obamacare, that Medicare is going to morph into Obamacare, is intrinsic to the healthcare reform idea. Many of the healthcare wonks agree with that. Now, the ones who are thoughtful believe that it shouldn't happen until Obamacare is very well established, and then perhaps create a Medicare option within it so that people could buy in. There'd be a public option for everyone. But that's always been part of it. Now, what was interesting to me is over the weekend I saw Avik Roy, who's a healthcare analyst for the Manhattan Institute, a conservative. He was on Mitt Romney's team. He agreed with that. He said the whole point of entitlement reform is to fold Medicare into Obamacare. So you can see the outlines of this, and I think that those of us on the left who were arguing for public option, we were set up to believe that Obamacare was going to eventually go the other way, right, and become a single-payer system of some sort, or at the very least have a single-payer option in it. And so that's kind of the underlying argument in this whole thing going forward. And people who, you know, activists, who, healthcare activists, need to understand that that's kind of the framework that we're dealing with. So this is just kind of step one in a long-term process.
Of essentially privatizing more and more of Medicare.
Exactly.
And making it it's basically turning it in. I mean, Obamacare is in many respects, when you get aside from the new regulations, at least in terms of providing more access to health insurance, becomes more of a form of welfare and subsidies program. Where
correct.
If you're a certain percentage above poverty, you get certain subsidies. Now, of course, there's a bit of a hole there. And we also know that if 65-year-olds and 66-year-olds were have to go into the private insurance market, even if they were to get subsidized in some instances, their premiums would be extremely high and can be high under Obamacare. And it would also create premium pressure for everybody's health insurance because you'd be adding the sickest and oldest people you can to the insurance pool.
Exactly. And in fact, I don't know if people have, I mean, I'm, you know, 55, so I'm old, and I'm already looking, you know, when I do the calculations of my health care, which is very expensive, and once you get into your 50s, I mean, believe me, you know, you can't even believe how high it goes. And it happens, you know, on a yearly basis. You're, and I'm healthy. I don't have any ongoing illnesses. But one of the, when I do the calculations for what's going to happen for me with Obamacare, I'm not helped particularly by Obamacare. I mean, I do get some of the regulation benefits, which is, you know, you get some free screening stuff and you get, you know, pre-existing conditions and that sort of thing. But as far as the premiums, under the calculations, that's probably not going to help me. And I'm far from being a rich person. And that means that when I'm 64 and 65, 66, 67, it's going to be even more expensive than it is right now. And I will probably still fall above the threshold or at the very edge of the threshold for any kind of meaningful subsidy. See, these subsidies, they get smaller and smaller as you go up the income scale. So when you're getting up to maybe, say, $40,000 a year, which in my view is not wealthy, you're paying high premiums when you're my age. And that is going to be, if you throw these 66 and 67-year-olds into the mix there, those are very high premiums they're going to be paying. And they're, you know, these are middle-class people. We're not talking about the, you know, the ultra-rich. They can pay for their own health care. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, just average working stiff who are probably lost their jobs on top of it because they're, you know, they're old. So, you know, this is a very dicey thing to do.
All right. So tell me what you think the relevance of, I mean, if we've established that the real leverage that the Republicans have, and it seems like, I mean, it's interesting to watch the sort of flow of the narrative here that comes out. I mean, we both absorb far too much political media, I think, for people to sustain without going slowly crazy. But the narrative seemed to be maybe not this past week, but the week before, that what it was starting to look like is that the Republicans were in retreat on the tax hikes and that they were going to create their last stand at the debt ceiling limit. And then the president came out, or not the president, but his spokesperson, and said, we're not going to use the 14th Amendment, any power that is vested in the president under the 14th Amendment, to circumvent Congress's approval of the debt ceiling. We're not going to use the platinum coin trick, which is basically the Treasury has it within its constitutional authority to mint a coin, as long as it's platinum for some reason, in any denomination they want, and they could just deposit it in the government's account. We're not going to use that. This is going to be a Boehner's problem. But when you say it's Boehner's problem, it suddenly becomes all of our problem. There's no way to just keep it Boehner's problem. And then it seemed we saw the next sort of twist to this, which is, again, the compromises that the administration has to make. Give me your sense of what's going on with that flow. Is that the way that you would characterize the way this argument's gone?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Well, I mean, in my view, we may see a two-step process. We may see a preliminary agreement happen before January on the taxes with some, you know, with some promise to maybe do Medicare. And then I think that there's going to be a second round of this, which will be around the debt ceiling. And I think my personal belief is, and, you know, people can disagree with this, but I think the president still has it in mind to do a great big deal. I think he still wants to do that. And I think he sees this, these things as a sort of, you know, it's like the Rahm Emanuel, there's the don't, or the shock doctrine concept of don't let an opportunity go to waste to do all these things. The president has always wanted to do that. And people argue with that and say, oh, you know, he's just stuck, but he's been saying it from the time he came into office. I think he wants to do a big deal. Now, it may have to be in two parts here, maybe even more. They may have to take Social Security on because they've taken that off the table, more or less. That may have to be a third step on this. But that's how I see it unfolding. You know, unless – now, you know, there's always the wild card in this is the House. And if the conservatives in the House, and I get the feeling that they're, you know, doing the big L foldo, but if they don't, then they may hold this deal up again. And then there are the progressives in the House. And if this deal is too bad, they might be the ones to hold it up on the left. And then Obama will try and do some serious arm twisting, but I think that he has less clout than he did 2 years ago.
I mean, it's interesting because I think, you know, when you talk about the sort of the outlines of how that two-step process would go and mentioning that Medicare will be dealt with later, I mean, this is the way that you sort of diffuse the opposition to it, right? I mean, because you yeah. make a deal, okay, we've got the Republicans to agree to raise taxes a little bit less than they would just go up in a week anyways. And in return, we are committed to doing something about Medicare. Now, it's very hard for people on the left to argue, well, you know, against something that is so sort of like ephemeral. But then 2 weeks later, the argument or the debt ceiling, you go, well, we did make a promise to deal with Medicare. Yeah. So we're locked into that. I mean, so this is the way that you do it. I mean, every time I negotiate with my daughter, this is what I do. This, because I know I've got the upper hand. I mean, I'm only slightly smarter than her. Her will is greater than mine, as far as I can tell. Now, she's only 7, so I still hold out hopes that she's
a lot like a Republican.
Exactly. And this is the way that I do it. You know, I sort of drag her part of the way, and then she forgets about where we started from. And I just referenced the last little deal that we made. Oh, yeah, right. I got to go to bed now. And this is what makes me very nervous. Now, give me your sense. We have Nancy Pelosi come out. And like you say, I think Social Security has been at least pushed off the table for the time being. We had Nancy Pelosi come out pretty strong saying that raising the Medicare eligibility age was a stupid idea. And then Dick Durbin had an appearance this past weekend on one of the weekend shows, which is in some ways being touted as him coming out against the raising the Medicare eligibility age, too. But I think you made a point that he didn't really do that.
No, he played dumb. And weirdly enough, I mean, actually Pelosi did, too, in an earlier interview, which I hadn't seen at the time. And then I went back and saw it. When she was making comments, they both played dumb. They said, well, what are we going to do with all these seniors who were kicked off of Medicare? What will happen? We can't, you know, what are you talking about? That's just crazy talk. Well, we know that isn't true. I mean, even Avik Roy, the guy from the Manhattan Institute, understood that the idea is to put those people under Obamacare. So, you know, I don't know what that means. I mean, I have to be honest. Maybe it means nothing. Maybe Dick Durbin, you know, is terribly uninformed about these negotiations. I doubt that since he's at the center of them, but hey, you know, what do I know? But whatever it is, there is something there that's very curious because they, of course, know what the plan is. And the idea that they're playing dumb about it makes me realize, to me, and again, you know, just reading tea leaves, that says to me that it is definitely part of the negotiations. The fact that they both sounded like idiots on that issue made me realize that this is in play.
I just want to be explicit with this so that people understand. Dick Durbin is not putting up a blanket opposition to the idea. He's simply saying, like, there's a problem here, and I don't know how we deal with that problem. And now the implication being that, well, if somebody came in and gave me a decent solution to that problem, I could change my mind. He's saying this, and what Digby is arguing is that he's saying this with full knowledge that there's a supposed solution to this out there. And so he's inviting people to come to him with this solution. And I think, you know, this is the thing that people have to understand as the way that politicians work. They allow them so they can set up a premise that they know can be dealt with. They set up a predicate. Here's the roadblock, folks. And I'm just waiting for somebody to come and tell me how we can get around this roadblock. Oh, that's convenient. Here comes that guy with that route around the roadblock. So, all right, let's talk also about the concept of a trial balloon. And all in the concept of the in context of this sort of hippie punching that is going on, because I want people really to understand, and many people I think do understand this, but I want to make sure that everybody understands this, that the idea of this concept of a trial balloon and what's supposed to happen and what the people who favor the idea in the trial balloon, what they're doing to make sure that people don't fire their slingshots at that balloon and sink it.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, first of all, I think everybody, I'll just, you know, define it briefly. A trial balloon is just in the midst of a negotiation when someone puts out the rumor that something is being considered for the express purpose of gauging reaction. And, you know, either that or, you know, trying to push the narrative in the press, and I think that's a big part of it, to sort of come to accepting this particular thing prior to it actually being announced. So you don't know where that is, but, you know, one of the things that happens in these trial balloons is that those of us who object to it, which I consider our responsibility, I don't know if they're selling out Medicare. I'm not in the room with Boehner and Obama. But when I hear that it might happen, I'm going to scream loudly and perhaps somewhat shrilly in opposition, because I think that that's, As a caring citizen and someone who has, you know, feels like I have a personal as well as a personal stake in this, I think we should object. And I think that even if you grant the Democrats, you know, having our best interests at heart, they need for us to object because they need to have the backing. If they're trying to avoid doing something terrible, they need to be able to go to John Boehner and say, hey, you know, you got your Tea Party, but look at, I've got all these liberals who are losing their minds over this. I can't do it. So this is an important role that we play in this. Now, what happens on our side, unlike the on the right, where they kind of, you know, have a built-in respect for their base, and they sort of, you know, they walk very carefully when this happens. On our side, you get hear this tremendous push from the centrists and the political establishment trying to marginalize voices like mine or yours, Sam, or any of the rest of us out here who are screaming loudly and saying, oh, don't be silly. That's just crazy. Why are you doing that? You know, you need to, you know, just trust the administration and do whatever. Now, you know, my personal feeling is that these are not naive people and that for the most part, they're doing that because they're trying to establish this as, you know, an acceptable compromise. And so I fight back hard on that, and perhaps I do it in a somewhat rude fashion at times, but I think it's important to ensure that people understand that there's a consequence to floating ideas like that that are unacceptable to a large portion of the Democratic Party.
Well, first off, let me say that you're one of the most polite people I know. and secondly, what I really enjoy as we watch this back and forth, a lot of it has played out between like David Dayen and Jonathan Chait and yourself and Atrios and you see guys like Iglesias and Jonathan Cohn at the New Republic sort of weighing in on the margins to this. And on listservs across the sort of the center-left spectrum, my favorite is that you've got Ezra Klein and Jonathan Chait reporting now, right? They're just reporting. This is my favorite aspect of this, and this is what became so clear to me when I had that exchange with Donahue Peebles. They keep jumping back and forth between reporting and advocating. And like, I'm not saying I'm in favor of this, although I can see its merits. I'm just reporting that this seems to be happening. And at the same time, they say, but there are other voices say like, well, why are you reacting to this? It hasn't happened. There's no reason to believe it's happening. You're crazy to be screaming about something that hasn't happened, although it's, yes, there's just been a report or two, but why are you getting so worked up about a report or two? People should understand that these are different levels of arguing in favor of that happening.
Right. Right. I mean, this is a way of saying, of arguing in favor of it, but keeping your distance from that argument. And, you know, I mean, you see people who have shows on TV who will bring on advocate after advocate for a particular position and then say, well, you know, I'm not taking a position. I'm going, well, you know, you do book the show.
You
could have booked someone who had a different position. I mean, this happens all the time, right? So, you know, you have to, and you're constantly kind of coming up against that if you're an outside commentator, someone who isn't part of the political establishment. And, you know, there's a whole kind of social aspect to this. There's, you know, everybody's friends with everybody. There's this kind of coziness that makes it very difficult for people who live within that to be aggressive in this situation, which is why I thought we had the blogosphere. You know, I live in LA, you know, I don't care. I'm going to say what I think. And, you know, so I think that that's one of the values of having outside people who can sort of brush up against that and you know, push back on that phenomenon a little bit.
My sense is that this is a perfect example. I mean, because we're playing in what is a very unique following the re-election of President Obama puts us in a very unique position in terms of being able to agitate for this stuff in an unshackled fashion. Because the funny thing is that we had this same argument, and I don't think it could have played out in this way, but let's say the same argument, the same debate played out in September. People like you or I would be attacked by people who saw this as weakening the president. And, so we would be attacked by an entirely different cohort of people now, which I don't see happening to the same extent. I mean, we would be labeled, I guess, firebaggers, which, you know, was not a term I was even remotely aware of. I think it was until I filled in for Hayes and said something that was in some way critical of the president. And then all of a sudden my Twitter feed came up with all these terms that I was like an emota prog or progamo or emo prog.
You're lucky. Emo prog.
I hadn't heard any of these before. And that seems to be now it's you don't see that as much because I think there's an understanding like, okay, the president is now elected. He cannot be unelected. And there's to the extent that there's any electoral implications to this, it's all coming essentially from the House. And for the most part, they can't run on cutting Medicare. They can't run on cutting Social Security.
I wouldn't think so.
No.
I'm not sure that either side can.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think this is a bizarre thing to me that anyone would think that would be you know, a good thing to run on in 2 years. But you're right. There's a different phenomenon happening here. We're back to a status quo before Obama was originally elected in, which is that the battle line seems to be more concentrated on, you know, on the liberal progressive side against the political establishment. And that is, you know, I think the more, I mean, I should say that's where the philosophical lines really are. Before this, there was personal loyalty and fear of Romney and God knows what else. But now we're talking about, you know, the philosophical divide being defined as it really exists within the Democratic Party.
Yes. And frankly, I mean, this is one of the, this was one of my affirmative arguments as to why we want President Obama. I mean, aside from the implications of Romney, is that this makes it very, very clear as to where these lines are drawn. And it also, I believe, enhances, and I want to get your take on this, enhances the power of progressives pushing back very strongly. I mean, I think it makes, frankly, what you do that much more important, because it is a voice out there when these trial balloons go up. This is a trial balloon for the left. It's not for the right. And I don't think it's, you know, for the establishment. Of course they want to cut Medicare and Social Security. It is to see how much can we get away with. And it's at moments like this, and particularly because we're talking about influence with House members, you know, where actually, like, you know, 1,000 people in your district can make a big difference if you're running for Congress. This is where I think our power increases and our ability to scream and yell about stuff increases dramatically.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think even in terms of the president, and people will disagree with this, but I think you and I have talked about this before, that you know, President Obama is now, he's no longer going to running for anything ever in his life again. So he is in the process of establishing his legacy. Mm-hmm. And that is going to depend in large part on the liberals. And he will never be extolled by the right as a great president, if that's what he cares about. So at this point, he has a different relationship with us as well. It's not quite the same. You know, he needs something from us now in a way that he didn't. Now, I don't know how powerful that is, and maybe it isn't powerful at all, but I do think it exists. And as far as the House members are concerned, this is huge, and that is the one place where the work that we've been doing over the past few years, unabated, in working on the House of Representatives, many groups from Credo to Move On to my group, Blue America, we have been, you know, working very, very hard to have an influence on the House Progressive Caucus. And I don't know if you've noticed, but this time you've got, at the very least, I mean, it's not everything, and I don't know how strong these people are going to be, but you've got Keith Ellison out there, you've got Raul Grijalva out there, you've got, you know, various members of the, you know, Peter DeFazio, various members of the Progressive Caucus out there making a public argument for the progressive side, which is no cuts. They are actually saying that. And that's different than it was last time. I mean, there were a few, but this time it's a much more systematic kind of program, and they're out there doing that. And all of these people know, believe me, they do know, that if they vote against this, if they do, there will be repercussions on the left. And they are we have a much more direct and very clear influence with them than we do with the president, for instance, or even the Senate. But, I mean, so I think that the stakes are very much different, as you say.
Yes. Well, Digby, as always, tremendous pleasure to talk to you about this stuff. We will be back in touch. Hopefully nothing will happen between now and January 1st, but we shall see, and we will talk about either the implications of what did happen or of what we anticipate happening soon enough. Again, Digby from the blog Hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the better half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. And this is, I mean, it's extremely important time for us, I think, to to amplify our voice. And not just is it important, I really do believe, and was quite happy to hear that Digby believes so too, because I consider her extremely intelligent about these things, that we have more leverage now than we've had in a long time. Much more leverage, because we're talking about, we can actually, the progressive caucus in the House can actually sink this thing, because you're not going to get all these Republicans. I mean, a lot of Republicans have to posture against even raising the top marginal rates by 2%. And they're not going to be able to go back and brag that, wow, I was able to get cuts in Medicare. And so it's the progressive caucus that we need to show them, and the Democrats in the House, as well as pushing back, frankly, on the so-called center-left voices. Because they have a stake in your involvement. You know, somebody's got to read Jonathan Chait. And so there is a tremendous, we are the most empowered, I think, sitting in our underwear in front of our computers now than we have been in a long time. And so I'm excited about that opportunity. I'm also terrified about the, what we may come down the pike. But I'm excited at least about the opportunity that's here for us. And also, I think part of it has got me so excited is also this credo thing, because it's nice to have an outlet that can expand our voice. And so we have that link on the blog to credomobile.com/majority. Through that porthole, not only can you check out all the stuff that you can get on an entrepreneurial basis from Credo in terms of their phones, we'll give all the details about this in the coming days, about they will buy you out of your contract up to, I think, $350. I got to just check the details here. But I do know that a big percentage of their profits goes towards, I think you can also find the link there too, to what they funded in 2011. They have action programs where you can send petitions that will be dropped off to Congress people, to the White House and whatnot. And this is one of those occasions where I really think, I mean, they had a lot of success. There was a couple of different organizations out there that were pressuring Congress people to sign off on the discharge petition that Nancy Pelosi was pushing around, essentially to force a vote on a middle-class tax cut now. I think they got up to about 180-some-odd signatures, which is about as high as they can get. And these are important leverage points. It's and it is, to a certain extent, it's very inside baseball, but, you know, that's what, yes, well, that's what we're, if there's a show that does more inside baseball to more people in any context anywhere, other than probably that show Inside Baseball, isn't there a show on ESPN called Inside, I'm using it as a metaphor. I don't know what that show is. All right, we're going to take a break, head into the better half, the number 646-257-3920. Again, if you can afford to become a member of the Majority Report, you can do so now at majority.fm. Always nothing better than to sit on your phone. Your phone, which you know is supporting, your usage is supporting causes you believe in, and having a great cup of coffee from justcoffee.coop. Yeah, you like how I work that in? Fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate. Organic if you want it. And if you already are a Credo user, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Tell me why you like doing it. I'm curious to hear.
Use your Credo phone to listen to the Majority Report while drinking your Just Coffee coffee, while you're surfing your computer, buying stuff from our Amazon link. Mm. There we go. Mm. I think I just...
Filling out our survey with that.
Oh, my God. It's like a Majority Report lifestyle. You've just been Majority Report-sized.
All right, we'll see you in the better half. 646-257-3920. I am Machine is up. See you there.